Why wouldn't you vote? It's like attendance for the politicians, so they know you're paying attention.
After a long campaign season, Alaskans cast their ballots. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a domestic violence survivor describes why she stayed in an abusive relationship.
I was so in love with him, and he said he was so in love with me and he wanted to marry me that I stuck around.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready to quit smoking using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Alaskans across the state are casting ballots today. There is a lot at stake. Voters are deciding two of Alaska's three seats in Congress, along with the governor and state House and Senate seats. There are also three statewide ballot measures on marijuana legalization, the minimum wage, and Bristol Bay. A steady stream of voters filed into Airport Heights Elementary this morning to vote. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned they had a variety of motivations.
24-year-old Karan Hood has never voted before.
I was one of those kids that was like, oh, I don't want to have a hand in the whole government thing and all this and that. But I've learned eventually that they basically fought for our rights to vote, so might as well just give it a chance.
He walked to the polling place through the crisp breeze with his friend Phyllis Copiaz, who's been a regular voter for decades.
I always vote.
Why?
Why wouldn't you vote? It's like attendance for the politicians, so they know you're paying attention.
For Justin Craver, the voting isn't about the politicians, it's about the ballot measures.
Don't really care about the people really in charge. I feel like they're kind of all the same. So I like voting on things.
On the measures and the initiatives.
Yeah, I feel like it's more impactful on my day-to-day life.
Tom Boney, decked out in his American flag suspenders, says he thinks it's often the specific issues that drive turnout during election. He and his wife have been voting in Alaska for more than 50 years.
But I notice that when different things are on the ballot, different people show up. We're here all the time, so. Hip, hip, hooray for the senior citizens, right?
Yay!
They're the standby.
His wife, Sandra, says they come for practical reasons.
You bet I've always voted. I wouldn't miss it. Because, hey, if I don't vote, then I can't gripe about what's going on. You bet.
A few minutes after entering the school, Hood walks out after casting his first ballot.
So do you feel different?
Yeah, I feel awesome. I mean, I made a change and I'm glad to see what the outcome is.
He'll find out after the polls close at 8 o'clock tonight. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Federal Subsistence Board's rural determination process will change, according to an announcement made at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention last month. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
The changes would mean a more favorable process for villages and other rural communities that rely on hunting and fishing. Deputy Secretary of the Interior Michael Connor told AFN attendees that the new regulations will come soon.
We're moving out, beginning the discussions. We've got to consult with the state. Overall, this is strongly supported throughout the leadership at the Department of the Interior.
Title 8 in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, mandates a subsistence preference for rural residents on public lands. Every 10 years, the Federal Subsistence Board determines whether a community meets certain guidelines to qualify for ANILCA's subsistence preference. That rural determination process has been harshly criticized in recent years. In 2007, several communities were told that they were no longer considered to be rural, including the southeast community of Saxman. The board reasoned that the community's proximity to non-rural Ketchikan put it in the same category. While the community is incorporated as a municipality, a majority of the population is Alaska Native and are members of the organized village of Saxman. The tribe has fought against the board's attempt to take away their rural status, arguing that they have a history of traditional subsistence gathering in the area. The determination was put on hold in 2009 by then-Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar, pending a comprehensive review of federal subsistence policies. That hold was scheduled to expire this past July, which meant that the tribe's opportunity to litigate would also expire. In April, the Federal Subsistence Board voted unanimously to submit new regulations for the rural determination process. The board does not have authority to approve new regulations, but it can propose them to the Department of the Interior and the Department of Agriculture. While Connor did not give details of the proposal, he did say that the board will defer more to communities and tribes in its decision-making process.
Once implemented, the new determination process will enable the board to utilize more flexible criteria that could lead to the kind of determination sought by AFN and others in cases such as Saxman in Southeast Alaska.
Native American Rights Fund attorney Matthew Newman represents the Saxman tribe. He says the proposed rules give residents hope, but that the outcome is still in question. While the tribe favors an administrative fix, Newman says the lawsuit won't be dropped until they've had a chance to review the new rules and are satisfied with them.
I think everyone is relieved and optimistic that the rule is going to move forward. This rule moving forward is not just a good thing for Saxman, it's a good thing for all rural communities who are subject to ANILCA's priority. This rural determination process has really just been a bane for many communities. And this idea that every 10 years your way of life is potentially subject to change causes a very, very uneasy feeling among rural residents in Alaska.
Deputy Secretary Connor also announced changes in the board's makeup. Two additional public members were added, Anthony Christensen of Heidelberg and Charles Brower of Barrow. Former AFN co-chair Tim Twarek from Unalakleet was named chair of the board. Connor said his department is working on a new process that would make it easier for communities and subsistence users to participate in the board's decision-making process. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
The Fairbanks City Council has unanimously voted down a labor contract with public safety employees, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The labor agreement would cut the work week from 40 to 36 hours, provide a 10% wage hike, increase the city's contribution to health insurance, and provide additional vacation time for officers with 10 or more years on the job. The contract was approved by the city council in August, but then taken back for reconsideration. Monday's vote to reject it followed extensive public testimony, including from police union representative Jake Metcalf.
Your employees are underpaid. Seriously underpaid when you look at the cost of living, when you look at the CPI, and when you look at what they make compared to other employees. I urge you tonight to pass this contract. We believe you pass this contract. We believe we have a contract.
Metcalf threatened to file unfair labor practices charges if the council rejected the contract. The council also heard testimony from several police officers. Longtime FPD officer Sergeant Gary Yamamoto said the labor contract dispute and the city's recent decision to hire a chief from outside are dragging down the department.
There have been several times in the past when morale at FPD has been very low, but nothing compared to now.
City Council member Jerry Cleworth led the charge to reject the police contract, pointing to the reduced work week as a step backwards.
Everybody in this room should be upset with that, because we have worked for so long to get it up to the staffing that we have now, and it's been painstaking. And we're going backwards.
Cleworth said the city is mandated by code to treat employees similarly and that the police contract would set a precedent that it cannot afford to match with other unions.
We can't do the same thing for the other three bargaining units. We can't come anywhere close to that.
Mayor John Eberhardt challenged the notion that all city labor contracts have to be comparable.
That's not what's happening in negotiations. These are different units, different type of work, different requirements. It's not realistic to think you can somehow treat them completely alike.
It's unclear how the situation will be resolved with the potential for both legal action and more bargaining. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau has a new sister city.
Filipinos are a big part of Juneau, I think, and it just shows that the city of Juneau really appreciates us.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Less than a year ago, Catherine Walchak was mentally and physically abused by someone she loved and trusted. She is slowly getting her life back on track. The 23-year-old wants to tell her story to bring awareness to the issue of domestic violence and hope to those who experience it. APRN intern Ashley Snyder has the story.
I knew Catherine Walchak as an acquaintance. We had a few classes together at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. She seemed confident, friendly, and like her life was on top of the world. But underneath, she was hiding an abusive relationship. Catherine says when she first started dating her boyfriend Demetrius, he seemed like a decent guy, and the two were very much in love. 2 months later, she got pregnant, and they decided to move in together. Almost immediately, things changed.
He's been abusive towards me. He's broken shit. He's spilled hot coffee on me. We lived on the third floor of an apartment, so he threw all of my stuff out the window and then into the dumpster. That went on for months when we were together and living together. But I was so in love with him, and he said he was so in love with me and he wanted to marry me that I stuck around.
Catherine stayed with Demetrius through her pregnancy. In October, their son was born. She thought Demetrius seemed unhappy as a new dad, but he told her he loved their son and that he wanted to be a good father. He watched the baby while she was at work. One night, when she was at home feeding her baby, Demetrius took him from her arms and went into another room.
My son screamed on the top of his lungs. He was holding him. A fountain of blood was coming out of his mouth, and I was like, what the f*** did you do? And he's like, I didn't do anything. So I went to the emergency room, and the doctor told me that all of his ribs have been broken, his clavicles, his left leg, left arm. He was bleeding internally because he was punched in the mouth a couple of times. His neck is broken. So pretty much my son, his whole body is broken.
Doctors told her the trauma was not all a result of what had just happened. It was the accumulation of weeks or even months of abuse. She had sometimes noticed slight bruising in the past, but she had read that babies bruised easily and didn't worry about it. Catherine was devastated.
He was abusing my infant son on a regular basis when I was at work. And then when I figured it out, oh, I was out.
Catherine told police, and Demetrius was arrested and charged. She moved out of her apartment and back in with her parents. Her son stayed in the hospital for several weeks. He eventually got to go home, but his health problems persisted to the point that she could no longer care for him herself.
I have full custody of Christopher, but my son Christopher is living in Anchorage with special parents. They're worried later on in life that he's going to have a lot of disabilities. He took out all of his aggression on an infant, and I don't know what normal human being would ever do that.
Domestic violence in Alaska is a serious issue. In 2011, a UAA victimization survey found that in Anchorage alone, 60% of women have experienced domestic violence and sexual assault. But there are organizations like Abused Women's Aid in Crisis, or AWAKE, to help victims get out of abusive situations. Deputy Director Melissa Emmel explains rates of domestic violence are increasing for people like Catherine, aged 18 to 24.
Our community needs to do a better job at targeting young people with information about what healthy relationships look like.
Those who do get out and get help can take months or even years to recover, but Melissa is proud of what they can accomplish.
I've been working with people who've experienced abuse for a little over 10 years, and I'm always amazed at the resiliency and strength that I see in people who've been through trauma, you know, throughout their whole life, and maybe a big traumatic incident of violence that caused them to get out of a relationship.
It has been over 9 months since Catherine left Demetrius. She says surrounding herself with friends and family has helped her recover.
I had my head back on my shoulder. Honestly, I don't know. I guess I'm just a tough cookie. I'm just really strong, and I have to be strong for my son because I'm the only thing that he has, really.
Her ex-boyfriend is in jail awaiting sentencing. Her son is still living with his special needs family, continuing to recover from his injuries. Catherine chose to start a new life in Nevada, and now she travels up to Alaska every few weeks to visit her son until he can live with her again next year. Catherine is hopeful about the future, but picking up the pieces hasn't been easy. In Anchorage, I'm Ashley Snyder.
Juneau gained its fifth sister city this weekend. Representatives from Calibo in the Aklan province of the Philippines signed documents to formalize the agreement. Juneau and Calibo are both vibrant tourism centers and regional capital cities. KTOO's Kayla DeRoche has more.
About 3,000 Filipinos live in Juneau, and roughly 800 of them are from Aklan. Vicky Roldan is one of them. She's been in Juneau for 21 years and says family is the reason so many Calibo residents move here.
Because of intermarriages and all that, and they keep bringing family over here.
Alex Carrillo was born and raised in Juneau and says the Filipino population has always been a tight-knit community.
Just growing up in the Filipino Hall, around, you know, even people that weren't our relatives, we were so close back then because that's all we had was one another. The Filipino Hall is a really big part of my life.
He says Juneau's bond with Calibo is more than just a sign of goodwill towards the Philippines.
Filipinos are a big part of Juneau, I think, and it just shows that the city of Juneau really appreciates us.
While in Juneau, the Calibo delegation did some sightseeing at destinations such as the Mendenhall Glacier and the Shrine of St. Therese. They also visited local businesses like the Alaskan Brewing Company. Many expressed hope that the sister city connection will encourage an exchange of goods, services, and information. Dr. Macarius de la Cruz is Calibo's municipal health officer. He says Aklan needs support to provide better health care to its residents.
Your government could help my government to provide medicines, equipments, and also promote nutrition in our town.
Typhoon Haiyan hit the Philippines last November and damaged buildings in Aklan. Juneau's Filipino Community Incorporated, or Philcom, reached out to those affected across the Philippines. Larry Snyder is on the Juneau Sister Cities Committee.
The Philcom had a fundraising event for relief money to assist Filipinos. And then the state, of course, donated two cargo planes full of Alaska Sea products, salmon, canned salmon.
Seafood is important to both Southeast Alaska and Aklan. Jenny Gomez-Strickler is the Philippines' honorary consul to Alaska. She wrote to Alaska Airlines to explore the possibility of a direct flight to Manila that could increase the amount of fish exported to the country. She says there are products that people in the Philippines could use that would otherwise go to waste in the United States.
In Alaska, our fishermen grind up the salmon head and throw it back in the ocean. I joke that that would be a taboo to Filipinos. Filipinos love making fish head soup. They call it sinigang.
John Pugh is the chancellor for the University of Alaska Southeast. He says there could be a trade in education.
Having the sister city relationship will enable us to work towards maybe some educational exchanges through agreement with Auckland University for students, for faculty exchanges, and we think that that could be a real benefit.
If the sister city relationship is successful, members of both communities hope it will also spark more tourism. In Juneau, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Just as soon as the doors opened at Bethel's new pool, they closed. Bethel City officials say there's a safety issue. Acting City Manager Pete Williams says a state fire marshal inspected the building before the grand opening on Saturday and found a problem with the sprinkler system.
They gave the blessing for the opening, and as long as the fire truck was hooked up to the building for that one day because of the opening. And right now, we have some equipment, some test equipment that isn't in town, that's en route, and hopefully late tonight or early tomorrow morning, probably realistically, they'll do some more testing and hopefully solve the problem.
Williams says the pool will remain closed until the problem with the sprinklers is fixed. The pool was welcomed by the community on Saturday with ceremonial cannonballs and trips down the slide. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
Hundreds watched as Beverly Hoffman made the grand opening plunge down the new slide. With that splash, the new pool was officially open, and the early reviews are positive.
Really fun.
Have you swam in there before?
Yeah. No.
First time.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
The pool quickly reached its full capacity, and dozens waited in line for their chance to swim. The $25 million six-lane pool is part of a complex that has a hot tub, weight room, and an open exercise room. Bethel's largest windmill provides about half the electricity. The pool has been a dream for 3 decades. Looking across the pool full of splashing kids, Hoffman, who's been the persistent voice for years, was emotional.
It's overwhelming because it's just what we wanted for this community, a place where families and kids could go and learn how to swim, learn how to be comfortable and dive in water, and it's amazing.
Ella Kingigak cut the ribbon Saturday and reflected on the long process.
I used to go into these hotels and they had swimming pools and all. And I used to wonder, if they can do it, I bet in Bethel, if we try, it wouldn't be too hard to try it out.
Uh-huh.
And we tried.
It took 3 decades and no one claims it was easy. A group of mothers, the YK Delta Lifesavers, over the years have baked and sold 20,000 pounds of cookies to raise funds. Bethel citizens twice voted for an increased sales tax for the pool. Its future was never certain as it faced opposition in some city councils and an uphill battle for grant money. YK Delta State Senator Lyman Hoffman and Representative Bob Herron worked to secure a $23 million state appropriation in 2012. Hoffman argued it was a matter of safety.
And we've had some of the highest drowning rates in the state and in the nation. So I don't think it's a nicety. I think it's a necessity to the people out here. And it's such a good feeling to finally be inside. This is my first day here. It's totally amazing.
The city hired an Atlanta-based company, USA Pools, to manage it. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Same-sex marriage is now legal in a majority of states, including Alaska. While support may be rising nationwide, there aren't any official LGBTQ organizations in Ketchikan, but there are unofficial support systems. Emily Files has the story.
Transgendered Ketchikan is an informal support group for queer people in Ketchikan. 6 of them were gathered at the Point Cafe on a recent afternoon.
I think there should be more safe places for people who are questioning their identity, just gender identity, sexuality, etc.
That's Ism, who used to identify as transgender, but now doesn't identify as any gender. Ism is one of the people who started this group about a year ago. Ism says there is a gay-straight alliance at UAS Ketchikan, but they didn't seem to be accepting of transgender people. And with the challenges queer people face in Ketchikan, a support system was needed.
Like most traditional, old-fashioned towns, it's kind of a hush-hush type situation if you don't follow the norm.
Holly Knorr identifies as pansexual, an attraction to people based on personality rather than gender. Knorr moved to Ketchikan from Wrangell with the hope that it would be a more accepting environment. And it is, but there's still occasional abuse.
You know, when I was kissing my girlfriend, a man started talking about how we were going to burn in hell. Things like that.
For Tyler Varner, outright discrimination isn't the biggest struggle. He's gay and says his family accepts him, but it's taken him a while to accept himself and become comfortable with who he is.
I feel like I have to put on this show so I can go out to dinner. And I think I just want to, like, strap on some damn fairy wings and, like, go to the club and, like...
Do the finger dance?
Pump it up.
Do the
I'm
knock.
Just... Yeah, I need to let go. It's stressful.
Austin Calkins, who identifies as gender fluid, says the people in this group often have to explain themselves to others.
There's always people looking, people asking, people all this stuff, inquiring just because, you know, you don't fit into the norm type of deal.
The only transgender person at this meetup is Scott Davis, or Sheen, who identifies as trans feminine. She has lived in Ketchikan for more than 30 years, but didn't feel comfortable coming out until a couple years ago.
Just get at a point in your life when you go, doesn't really matter, and I'm going to be happy.
Davis says at this point, she feels about 75% comfortable with being out in Ketchikan.
Because of the occasional physical or verbal abuse.
Can you remember the most recent instance of that?
This morning.
What happened?
Local place downtown. One individual worker referred to me as a freak. Hurts a lot less than it used to.
Davis says this group has given her the strength to ignore harassment like that. The group has helped other members in different ways. Here's Jacob Trumbull.
It took me a long time to accept that I didn't actually see myself as being of any gender.
Trumbull was only able to accept it and come out
just after this group was formed.
So did this group play a role in that?
Yes, very much so.
For the people here, they've found friends who accept and support them. But there are still times when they feel like outsiders. Here's Holly Knorr.
We're not a circus. We're not an act for somebody to watch. We're people.
For now, there are only unofficial support systems in Ketchikan for LGBTQ people, like this group. But that might change in the coming months. Davis says she and others are working to form an official LGBTQ advocacy group with nonprofit status.
If you have an actual formed LGBTQ group in a community, I think businesses, public government is a lot less likely to violate somebody's rights as a human being based on gender preference or appearance.
James Hoagland is a board member with the Juno nonprofit Southeast Alaska Gay and Lesbian Alliance. He says he doesn't know of any other similar organizations in Southeast. Without those support systems, Hoagland says LGBTQ people may feel isolated.
I think it would be really hard to connect to other people who do have that shared identity. I think people would feel alone.
Back in Ketchikan, Davis says the nonprofit she and more than 10 others are forming is private for now, because some of the members aren't out. She hopes by next year, the group will be public and Ketchikan will be home to a more prominent organization that can advocate for people like those gathered here. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us online on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Jennifer Canfield and Kayla DeRoche in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson and Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Emily Files in Ketchikan. APRN's Ashley Snyder reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at CrowleyFuels.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.